the What I Watch Tonight show.
Morning, afternoon or evening, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to Thriller Nights from What I Watch Tonight. My name is Matt Hudson, and joining me is my wonderful co-host from across the stars,
Ashley, aka the Movie Oracle.
Whoop, and she certainly is an oracle, guys, so check out her stuff. But how you doing, Ashley?
Freezing my limbs off. How are you?
I'm sweating my anus off. It's funny, because we are, as you can tell, on different hemispheres. Mm-hmm. Ashley, it would seem, would have the better luck because she's on the southern hemisphere, so they get shrimps on the barbie, they get the cool oceans, they get the shark attacks, and they usually get the weather. Whereas up here, we just get a nice cup of tea and, you know, a bit of apathy. So I would rather be down south where it's cooler, but I think Ashley would rather be up north in the northern hemisphere where it's hotter.
Correcto mundo.
There we are. See, I know her like her, but maybe I can be the oracle.
You wish. I'll go get the lawyers and I'll quickly go and get that phrase trademarked.
Yeah, I've been firmly whacked into my place there, but well, Thriller Nights, this show exists solely to focus on the chilling, the creepy, usually grim, generally great world of thriller movies. And each month, Ashley and myself, we're going to discuss a different movie from the genre and just get right into it. So Ashley, without any further, can you reveal the movie we're going to be reviewing for this first episode?
With great pleasure. Today we'll be talking about Copycat, which is a 1995 American psychological thriller directed by John Emile and written by Anne Bitterman and David Madsen. It stars Sigourney Weaver, Holly Hunter, Dermot Mulroney and William McNamara and centres around an agoraphobic psychologist and a female detective who must work together to take down a serial killer who copies serial killers from the past.
What turns on a serial killer is the suffering and death of another human being.
He's escaped again, hasn't he?
I'm sorry?
Well, is he out or isn't he?
I'm Inspector Getz. This is Inspector Monahan.
I got a couple of crank calls myself. That's why I thought Daryl E. Cullen must have gotten out of prison. There's a serial killer out there who strangled three women. He's gonna do it again.
It gets awful lonesome in here, Doc. I think about you all the time. Send me some of your squirrel covers.
These three are the work of the same man. This one is different. Did you put this in to test me? Well, where's the stocking that was tied around this one's neck?
How'd you know about that?
I mean, I assume it was a stocking and not pantyhose. Tied in a big loopy bow like this one, right?
Right.
Well, for goodness sakes, it's the Boston Strangler. He's imitating Albert DeSalvo's crime scene right down to the kinky little details.
Are you telling me this guy's copycatting a serial killer's been dead for
20 years?
Your panties.
1995. Now, that's 23 years ago, which is a long time, which makes me feel slightly old. I didn't realise this was that old, to be honest.
I'm still one of those people who you say something's from the 90s, and I'm like, oh yeah, that was just a couple of years ago, and then somebody says, no, it was actually 20, and I'm like, oh, shit.
I know, I remember. 1995, I used to be sitting down after school, eating my tea, watching Neighbours and Home and Away, not Copycat. But now, I finally got to see it again. I'll get into. We do have a structure in these episodes, so we're gonna kind of talk a bit about the film. Then we're gonna sort of go into the major plot points, and then afterwards we're gonna give our impressions and anything else cool that we came from it. So, in terms of Copycat, Ashley picked this film, but box office wise, it didn't do all that well in 1995. It got overshadowed quite a lot, which is could be seen as a shame. It was the 55th biggest film of the year. And I haven't got the worldwide stats, but it made about 32 million in the States. So, I don't know, about 45, 50 million adjusted for inflation. But so, in terms of when it came out, it didn't make the biggest splash. And I think possibly it's gained a bit more notoriety as years have gone by.
Certainly has. I mean, if you look at things that were coming, other films that were coming out in 1995, you can kind of see why. Because nobody ever really went and said, oh, it's a terrible film. It didn't get panned by critics. It was just that it didn't get noticed for critics to go and say anything about, because that was the year we had Toy Story, Die Hard with a Vengeance, Apollo 13, GoldenEye, Pocahontas, Batman Forever, Seven also came out, Casper Waterwell, even Jumanji. So you had a lot of big films that we still remember today coming out that just kind of meant that Copycat got kind of lost in the shuffle.
There were some absolutely awesome films that came out that year, so I guess Copycat's just a victim of its own release year, because had it been released maybe the year before, year after, it may have risen a bit and made a bit more cash. Maybe it wouldn't be. Maybe this is just the kind of film that just isn't destined to make an awful lot of money. But as we know, money and box office doesn't always equate to quality, because I mean, the Transformers movies make billions and they're shit. So
Hey, don't go there. Don't go.
Yeah, the first one is good.
Transformers.
Yeah, the first one is good. The rest of them can suck it.
The Transformers movies. My only main issue comes with the third one, and that's because I find it completely ridiculous that she's running around a dilapidated city and her jacket doesn't have a single stain on it, her hair and makeup are immaculate, her nails are perfectly manicured, and she's running around in stiletto heels. I find this unrealistic.
I could go through every film, but I'm not going to. And there's nothing wrong with people liking those films. I've said it on every show. I'd never sit here and poke fun at people liking films. They just aren't for me. But I loved the Transformers as a kid. And when they turned it into... One of them had massive bollocks, testicles, which were used as a weapon. I'm thinking, well, come on. That never happened when I was a kid in the 80s. And if it did, I must have missed that.
I think another one of the issues for Copycat is it actually got banned in a lot of theatres, which yes, obviously would affect how many people were going to see it. I don't necessarily agree with the ban. It was supposedly banned because there were two attacks on two girls in British Columbia, and apparently the crime was similar to the crimes committed of the Copycat, and I don't see how. For starters, the two girls survived, so there's that. And, you know, a lot of crimes are very much the same. You know, a person goes and attacks or kills someone, but nobody actually died in this one. I think it's a bit of a stretch, but they seem to not want people to get ideas. They didn't want this particular attacker to feel inspired by the movie, and they obviously didn't want to cause a panic, so they went and had it removed from cinemas out of respect for what had happened. But I'm not entirely sure if that was completely necessary, but nevertheless, it happened, so I think that kind of impacted the movie's response to the audience.
Yeah, I can see that. I get, absolutely, out of respect, it may have been the right thing to do for a short amount of time. I mean, do you know how long they were out of cinemas for that film?
I have no idea.
I mean, if it was like a month, 2 months, 3 months, that would have had a fairly major attack on its box office.
I don't know, but it makes it sound like the movie had already come out and then this crime happened and then they pulled it from the cinema. But I just don't really see a correlation between this and that, because, you know, there's a crime movie that comes out all the time and crimes do happen all the time, but we don't go around pulling every movie on the subject just because somebody got attacked.
Yeah, and sometimes, whether it's right or wrong, those kind of incidents can actually boost a film's box office numbers, because people are then intrigued by, well, why was this film banned? I want to go and see it. If it was impacted by if the real life event was impacted by the film, or if it's just a load of hoopla. So sometimes it can, you know, make people more interested and can get a few more quid in the box office. But The film itself, it's John Amiel, as you mentioned, directs it, who also directed The Core and Entrapment. Well, again, depending on your likeness of films, you'll either like those films or not. I thought The Core was pretty good. And it's also got two very decent, very, very, very decent leading ladies in Sigourney Weaver and Holly Hunter.
Mm. That's one thing that I find it funny. Everybody today, you know, keeps talking about we need more female leads. I'm like, you do know there are a lot of films out there that did have predominantly female leads and they don't get much recognition. But this one, definitely, you have your two main focuses of the film are played by two great female actresses. And then you've got your male lead is technically completely off screen for the majority of the film. So, you know, it's not like everybody's going, oh, who's that guy? I think most people didn't even know his name. He's just one of those kind of people who does a great job, but you never remember their name, mostly because their faces weren't on the screen.
Yeah, I struggled to remember who the bloody hell he was as well. But, I mean, he had Sigourney Weaver, was before this film came out, and I think still now, was a three-time Academy Award nominee. And Helen Hunter had recently just won an Academy Award for The Piano, I think. So, you've got two absolutely awesome leads. And then you've got sort of very decent backup, like Will Patton. And Harry Connick Jr. as well shows up. William McNamara and Dermot Mulroney make up the rest of the cast. But, yeah, the ladies are the leading lights in this film. And I don't pull that up just because they're ladies. It just happens that they are by far the best parts of the film as well. But I just thought I'd throw that out there because in this day and age, as you mentioned, there is a clamour for more recognition for what actresses bring to cinema. And if this film's anything to go by, they're generally better than the males half the time.
That's true. I think there is a good decent of comparison to make between this film and films being released right now. And not just because obviously there's like 20 years difference, but it's also that I feel, and I may be alone in thinking this, but it seems like the work that actors put into researching roles, it seemed like there was more effort put into it back in the day than there are now. Like you find someone's been cast in, you know, an American's been cast to play someone in who's meant to be British. And it's like, oh, what did you do to prepare for the role? You know, I went and lived in England for 2 weeks. It's like, okay.
Drank some tea.
It's like, okay, good work. Whereas in this one, you know, you've got Sigourney Weaver, who went and actually talked to the person, she consulted with the leading forensic psychiatrist, Park Dietz, who had interviewed serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer. So she was trying to figure out how is it for a person who is in that profession, who has, you know, come face to face with serial killers. And then, of course, she put a lot of work into playing someone who's agoraphobic, not how do we want to play this and more how do you play it accurately. And then Holly Hunter, she, of course, spent time with detectives in their precinct seeing how they worked so that she could play it more accurately. And Harry Connick Jr., he was watching documentaries about serial killers to kind of get into that mindset and portray them. So a lot of work on the actor's part went into it to make this a bit more authentic. And I kind of these days don't really see that level of work being put in by the younger generation of actors.
Yeah, I wonder why that is. I mean, I imagine Sam Worthington went to Pandora dressed up blue and, you know, really researched what happened in Avatar. But if he didn't, that's probably why he's cast in such crap films now. But back to it, I think maybe it's because there's just so many films coming out nowadays or TV is such a big medium now that maybe I'm not defending them because I do think you've got to do the research, you've got to prepare. Prepare to fail, but maybe there's just so much work going around that people can't devote the time they used to. I don't know. Or maybe it is just, a generational thing where these seasoned actors, if you will, of 20, 30, 40 years gone by, just that's just how they approach their craft. And I appreciate watching a film, checking out the trivia afterwards, and then finding out that the actors did spend time with their real-life counterparts to really, you know, nail down what makes that role so specific. I like it when they bring their own spin to it, which I believe Holly Hunter absolutely did, and Sigourney Weaver, of course. But it is nice afterwards when you think, oh, that was a good performance, and then it's validated by the fact that it was as honest a performance as it could be to the what they were portraying. So, yeah, you can tell they seem genuine, which is one of the things I pulled out from this film. But
yeah.
On that, shall we get into the film? Shall we talk about the major plot points of Copycat?
Oh, indeed.
I've got a cup of tea because I'm English and I'm a stereotype when I research my role. So I've got my tea with me now. Have you got shrimps?
For God's sake, we call them prawns. We don't put them on the Barbie. And no, what I have is pizza. I am eating pizza. There we go.
You certainly aren't a flaming galah now. I would fancy a pizza, to be fair.
Too bad, right. It's mine.
Okay, well, sod ya then. Copycat. Copycat starts off, I think, very well. We've got Helen Hudson, who has got a fantastic surname and isn't my mother, but she is played by Sigourney Weaver. So Helen Hudson, she's an expert on serial killers and their minds and what makes them tick and what, you know, what makes them do what they do. She is delivering a lecture on criminal psychology to a university. And long story short, she kind of points out that any of the men within the room, aged between, I think, 21 and 35, could wind up, or could theoretically be a serial killer. They fall into that demographic. Mm. There's one or two people in particular who seem to be paying quite a lot of attention to her. But I like that scene, the fact that it starts off, it's a proper, to me, it's a proper thriller type opening where it's quite slow. It's very quickly setting the scene, and it's also sowing some seeds of that elf mystery.
Mm. It's also a really good scene. If you go back and watch it more than once, you get more layers out of it.
Yeah, and if you can do that with any film, to me that's good writing and good visual trickery. But she, after the lecture, she's attacked in the bathroom by somebody called Daryl Lee Cullum, who's clearly a head case, and he's played by Harry Connick Jr., who's almost unrecognisable, but he's also one of her previous subjects, and he basically hangs her in a bathroom stall, and she doesn't die, but he hangs her, and it's implied that she is probably sexually assaulted, but we don't ever see what happens. But that scene itself is, you know, pretty visceral, pretty brutal.
Definitely. It's a really great setup, and of course, without it, you just have this person who is, as the synopsis says, she's agoraphobic. And without that background, there's nothing to really solidify why she is that way and why it's going to be harder during the events of the film to combat that, given what she has gone through. So it's quite an essential start to the film.
Yeah, and it doesn't take a long time for the film to really, you know, kick off. I mean, that's all within the first 7 to 10 minutes, maybe. And it really does set the scene. We know that Helen Hudson, we know what she does, we know what she's about. We now know who Daryl Lee Cullum is. Mm-hmm. We know what he's about, and we know his past. So we kind of already have your protagonist and an antagonist. But once that happens, the movie moves forward by 13 months, I believe. Helen Hudson's now withdrawn, and she's agoraphobic, living in a ridiculous high-tech apartment. I shout agoraphobic because so many people around the world disagree with our brilliant empire and call it agoraphobes. It's agoraphobic, and she is agoraphobic. And she lives in a house which is like a Picasso painting.
I'm thinking of some other choice words for you too, but, you know, I'm going to keep them to myself.
And a good morning to you too.
Evening for me, I don't care. Yeah, it's really great that suddenly you don't really know how the events between the beginning and the rest of the film start to go together. Really, until the movie starts to go along, you really start to think, okay, that just explains her, but then you realize there's actually so much more to it, and immediately we're brought into killings are going on across the city, women are being murdered, and the detectives are investigating it, and Helen kind of inserts herself kind of unintentionally to inform the police, hey, you've got a serial killer on your hands, to which they're just like, oh yeah, whatever. But she's the first one to go, well, do you not realize that these are replicas of a crime that's already been committed? And once she is involved in the investigation, that's when all the crimes start to escalate and reveal that this is indeed a copycat who is not just like any copycat, because he's not restricted to just copying one specific killer.
Yeah, they think the Monahan, which is Hunt, and the young hunk, Reuben Gertz, who's her partner, Dermot Maroney, they're on the case, and they think Helen's a crank, basically.
Yeah.
She calls them, offering advice or any kind of assistance, but they kind of just dismiss her as just some old weirdo calling up and wasting police time. And it's not until, you know, they go around to see her that they realise actually she may be onto something, and as you say, it's Helen who realises that the inspiration is being pulled from people like Berkowitz, Jeffrey Dahmer, Ted Bundy, the Hillside Strangler. People like that. That's in it. If it wasn't for Helen, these police would be chasing their tail and the body count would just grow and grow and grow. So, in fact, having her on board is what essentially begins to start to unravel these crimes.
It is interesting how this script is written. It honestly feels like it's written like this really amazing jigsaw puzzle, and how all the pieces start to come together. You can't really take out, well, maybe there's one bit you could take out. Besides that, you can't really take out anything out because it all works together, because you could then go and say, you know, at each moment you kind of might question something, but then the next moment will happen. It's like, okay, I've got the answer to that. I don't need to complain anymore. Like, you might ask, why is it when Helen gets involved, does suddenly he flip-flop and change who he's copycatting? And the whole point is that he was doing it because he was emulating a speech that she had done. He had been, essentially, he had been told to target her. This was really all about her. Part of it was himself, but she was the main focus. So he was waiting for her to get involved, and it wasn't until she finally did that he could start progressing with his crimes and going on with his plan. So everything really ties together quite nicely.
Yeah, it is that kind of connect the dots. The breadcrumbs have been laid out in the assumption that Helen Hudson will come on board, because eventually they're going to need the help from somebody who knows all about serial killers.
Mm.
And she does come aboard, but when she does come on board, that's when, her, like you say, her involvement in the case, she actually becomes the case almost, because the murderer then begins contacting and stalking her. And she and MJ then realise that the killer is actually after Helen. So they enlist Daryl Lee Cullum to try and help and find out what he knows about the killer. Can they draw anything out of his mind in terms of who is this guy, what is his motives, and why does he want Helen? So there's an awful, so in and amongst that kind of part of the film, there's a lot of really cool moments. There's Helen's PC is hacked, and there's this wickedly strange video with a lady's face, which turns into a really creepy looking skeleton, and she is implied to be the next victim. You get to see the old school 1995 MS-DOS style chat room, so that's a pretty old school throwback. And Daryl Lee Cullum also throws out one of the contenders of the decade for a use for the word pants or underwear.
Oh, it's quite... it just makes you cringe. It's quite fitting of the character that he's playing when he finds it's not appropriate to be saying the word panties to a lady. So instead he says squirrel covers, which apparently Harry Connick Jr. got the idea to say that from his brother-in-law. I really hope they're not brother-in-laws anymore, because
yeah.
Maybe you need to change the gene pool just a little bit.
I just wonder how we got the phrase squirrel covers, but when you watch the film and how he portrays the character and the accent which he uses and his mannerisms, it actually seems quite apt that he would use that phrase, and he is clearly more than a few screw looses. Few screw looses? He's got a few too many screws loose. Let me speak English today.
He's a squirrel with too many nuts.
Oh, yes. And he needs to cover them with his squirrel covers.
God.
I change my squirrel covers daily, so maybe he should do too. So, but yeah, so he comes on board after that wicked video. He comes on, he bargains. So basically, the whole point of the squirrel covers is he will help Helen out if she sends him some used panties, basically. That's what he wants as payment. And she kind of goes along with it and says, yeah, of course, you know, you'll get those. Just help us out. And he does agree to help them out. We soon realise later on in the film why. I thought that was it hasn't been used before. I mean, it's obviously Silence of the Lambs and things like that. But I like it when the goodies have to sort of basically enlist the bad guys into helping them take down another bad guy.
I think the brilliant part of all of this is you just kind of, for the entire film, you think that he's such a nobody. You kind of think that he's somebody who's also being used. You almost kind of see that, oh, as crazy as he is, he's kind of a victim too, that he's being manipulated. And then because, you know, he really only has three scenes in the movie. And for one, you're like, okay, he's crazy. Second one, you're like, okay, he's really fucking crazy. And then you get to the third one and you're like, oh, he's crazy, but he's also a evil mastermind, and he was the mastermind behind the entire thing. And it just creates this whole other perspective on it, where you kind of just think, okay, here's a guy who wants fame. And then you can look at it and almost on some very tiny little level have a little bit of sympathy for the guy, because he wants fame so badly and to have recognition for what he's doing, that he's made himself an easy target and he's being manipulated by someone who already has the fame, and he wasn't even seeking it out. It's just, he just got that because he was just that freaking crazy. And therefore, all the other crazies are drawn to him like, how do we become like you? Help us.
He has his minions.
He does.
But you find that serial killers do believe they want that fame. They want the attention. How many of them use the phrase contact the press or whatever to get their story out there, to get their notoriety out there, and to build their own legend? That's what a lot of them want. And it Daryl Lee Cullum is similar to that, except he clearly loves the fact that people follow him, whether or not he's after the world to know about him. But he clearly enjoys having people worship him, basically.
It's one of the funny things that I still to this day, I'm kind of going in two directions here. I can't tell whether this one particular scene was done because the character has to stick to the routine he set out, which is doing kills in the specific order of the serial killer names that Helen listed in her serial killer speech at the beginning of the film, or did he do it because there really wasn't any other way to go about it? I don't know if I'm making any sense here, but
No, yeah.
He gets to the point where he has to copycat Jeffrey Dahmer, and he does so by targeting Helen's friend who is gay, and what would you call him aside from her friend, like a carer, something like that?
Yeah, he's kind of, I would say guardian, carer more than anything. He pretty much lives with Helen for the most part.
Yeah.
Just to ensure her safety, for one, but also because she is agoraphobic, she is prone to episodes and whatnot now, and flashbacks. So basically, I guess so, yeah, he is there to care for her.
And it's not like she can do her own grocery shopping.
Yeah, she can't put her own washing out, so he's there to do that. He needs to put the squirrel covers out, so that's pretty much his job. He's like the squirrel cover saviour.
Well, he becomes our new victim of our copycat killer. And aside from the only two things that are anything remotely in Jeffrey Dahmer style is the fact that the victim was a gay man and that the head was cut off. But, you know, a lot of killers have used that modus operandi because Jeffrey Dahmer never dumped the bodies. He never promoted his kills. He got away with a lot of kills before anybody noticed. And I believe one of them was because a victim who he intended to, I don't know if he had raped him or he was going to, but the person came to and ran from the house screaming. And then, of course, people in the neighborhood for a while had been noticing this dreadful smell coming from the house. And it's because he had decomposing bodies in his house where he was trying to create, you know, zombie type lovers, where he was giving people chemical lobotomies and had people melting in oil drums. It's like, well, when you're a copycat who needs to have the public know what you're doing, emulating a serial killer who kept his kills private, kind of going to be a struggle. So dumping the body in the river was not at all Jeffrey Dahmer style. Jeffrey Dahmer never would have done that, but I guess he was kind of left with no choice. But for me, that particular kill was not at all in style of Jeffrey Dahmer. And considering at the end, when we see him trying to replicate Daryl Lee Cullum's attack on Helen, he has it so precise, like the shoe has to be in the correct spot. This has to be like this. And to do a Jeffrey Dahmer kill that's not at all like a Jeffrey Dahmer kill seems to just a little bit go against the psychopathy.
Jeffrey Dahmer was a fucking fruitcake, basically. Everything you've just said is utterly true, because Jeffrey Dahmer was, I mean, serial killers will never be called mental because that's not what they think they are, but he clearly was mental. But I guess to really portray Dahmer on screen, they would have had to, you know, have the victim, like you say, in oil or acid or decomposing in the house, and maybe they didn't want to go to that level, because you don't really see anything in this film, and none of the real murders really take place on screen, apart from that one where he's being asphyxiated. But you don't really see too much. So I guess if they were going to sort of allude to the fact that he was in a vat of oil or something, maybe they thought that was just too far. But yeah, if you're going to go for Dahmer, then you do have to knock it up a little bit, because he wasn't the most sane of chaps.
That's putting it mildly.
That is, yeah, he is an odd bod. Was an odd bod. Mm. But yeah, the killer's changed his tact now. But then, more tragedy strikes, because unfortunately the chunk of hunk, Reuben Gertz, is later killed in an unrelated shooting at the police station, which is the turning point for MJ, Helen Hunt.
Holly Hunter.
You've
done that twice.
God, thank you for not telling me the first time. Holly Hunter. So because she's kind of got a little thing for Reuben, but she kind of went unsaid. So she now has that on her mind. So they're continuing a search for the serial killer. So we've got a body count stacking up. We've got one of the investigators has been killed in an unrelated incident. We've got a heartbroken detective. And we have Helen Hudson's carer has also been murdered. So pretty much everybody who's involved in this film has lost something because of what's going on. So MJ reckons the killer may be somebody called Peter Foley. She's deduced this, and they've tried to catch him at his house, and that doesn't go all too well.
Not even a little bit. They assemble a SWAT team to invade the house, which seems to have been booby-trapped. Not only have they walked in to find that the woman who we assume that he is in a relationship with, who I would say that she's quite the dominant in the relationship, who's obsessed with her chihuahua, she has been shot in the head, she's dead, and as soon as they go to find his little psycho killer lair, immediately fire engulfs the house and it goes boom. I think a couple of the agents who went into the house were killed. I'm sure some were injured. But I understand his last kill was meant to be Ted Bundy. He was meant to kill a large number of people. This wasn't very Ted Bundy style. And I still can't remember if it actually said anybody was died in that explosion. But aside from the person that he shot in the head, but that's a little bit different. That's a little different.
I think he probably died.
Yeah. So, I don't know. It's like, I'm still confused on that scene. Like, was he trying to do a Ted Bundy and kill a large number of people in one go? Or was he just trying to get rid of evidence because they knew that he was on their tail?
Yeah, I'd like to think it was a bit of both. I'd like to think that he wanted to get rid of the evidence so he could prolong his spree. But also, like, sort of lean on the side as well, that he also wanted to take as many people out as he could. And if he could take some of the investigators out, some of their team, it also just leaves him open to carry on, because the evidence is gone, the masterminds behind trying to find him, for the most part, would be gone. So I like to think that he tried for it to be like a grand statement, which didn't really work all that well. Yeah, the guy who got shot in the head, I do believe he breathed his last. So I hear that could be quite fatal, getting shot in the head. But that may just be my naivety.
Actually, some people have been known to survive gunshots to the head.
Yeah, they do. I mean, they probably wish they had died, but I don't really fancy getting shot in the face to to see if that is the case. So moving on, because we do know that Ashley is a renowned serial killer at heart. Yeah. But we now get to the third act now, where shit gets real. Foley hasn't been caught. Peter Foley, we do see him earlier on in the film, but we'll get to that later on. MJ's discovered that he's actually kidnapped Helen. So Helen's buggered because she's been caught and her agoraphobia is going to strike because she's out of the house. And strangely and creepily and pretty messed up, she's been taken back to the scene of, well, the bathroom in the university where she was hung by Daryl Lee Cullen, the restroom. She's there. She's been taken back and she's been bound and hung and gagged in the same manner by Foley. And MJ finds her. And this is when it starts to really ramp up now.
I would say that this scene, aside from really getting to show William McNamara, like, this is his moment to shine, because everything mm-hmm. else has been so subtle and just brief snippets here and there. You don't really get to see him in the actual process of trying to set up a scene and do all that stuff. And then you see that he is he really is quite nuts, which is lovely. Although, funny story and quite disturbing, I did have a crush on the actor after watching this movie. True story.
Was it because of his lust for killing?
No, I just thought he was really cute when he took his glasses off.
Was it because of his ridiculous 90s haircut?
Hey, some people were into that. Worked for Jason Preston. I think that this moment in the film is so great. And also, I think that it's different compared to some of the other formulas that are used for thriller movies, where you may have your person who is usually the lead who has something that will hinder them in some sort of way, and they've got to conquer it and get past it. It's like, oh, miraculously, they got over it. The difference in mm-hmm. this was they show that Helen, even at the very, very end of the movie, she is not over her agoraphobia. I'm going to say it. Keep saying this, but I don't care if it annoys you. That she's still struggling. She is kind of, the entire time this is happening, she is in the middle of a panic attack and it's not ending. And so you're kind of between your brain trying to figure out how the fuck do I survive? Another nutcase is trying to kill me. And how do I keep myself conscious enough to figure out how to do that? And it's quite interesting to watch. And Sigourney Weaver does a fantastic job at this. Even when she, you know, manages to find a way, like, okay, hang on, I can get to him by ruining the scene for him. And that gives her an opportunity to get free. And even then, when she's escaping, she is still constantly battling the agoraphobia. And just in case people were not aware of it, and you just think she's exhausted from being hung from the ceiling, as soon as she gets onto the roof of the building where she's being held, she steps out, and as soon as she gets open, fresh air, she starts to completely become disoriented and lose focus, like she is about to pass out, and it's because she's having a panic attack. So I absolutely love that they keep this going and make sure that you know that, no, she's unstable, she's got issues. It's not we're going to completely magically erase them by the end of the movie, like, oh, wow, I can do that too.
Agoraphobia. Yeah, they didn't turn Sigourney Weaver into her Ripley character, because for the most part, she's fucking useless. She's withdrawn from society because of the awful incident that happened at the beginning of the movie. And she kind of just sort of meanders through the film. She sticks to her guns in terms of what she believes about the case, so she does give it to the police, like, this is what's going on, get your head out of your ass, because this is what's happening. But obviously, she can't. Every time she tries to leave the house, the camera does this wicked kind of effect where everything starts to spin and zoom in and out, and it's a really cool way of portraying agoraphobia. And then she gets captured again, and it's kind of like the hero of the film isn't kind of like the strong, heroic hero you're used to seeing. She's kind of like this flawed hero, which in that sense is probably more realistic, because if you have something like that happen to you, like that happened to Mrs. Hudson, who isn't my mother, because I love my mum and that's not my mum. It is gonna affect you. You're not just gonna get over it. And one of the alternate endings did have her conquering her agoraphobia, and the test audience were kind of like, well, that came out of nowhere, and rightfully they scrapped it and went with what they went with. But I am on your side there. I like that they kept it. And yeah, I think this purport of the film allows all three of the main actors in it, Holly Hunter, Sigourney Weaver, and Dermot Mulroney, to actually... it's not Dermot Mulroney, is it?
William McNamara.
That's it. I'm having an absolute nightmare of the cast list today.
He's long gone.
I'm having a nightmare of names today, so everybody do please excuse me. Yes, he is William McNamara. This is their time to kind of shine. This is where they all get a little bit of everything to do, except MJ is shot at one point and got knocked down unconscious by the blast. So she's out of the game for a part of this ending. But we all know she's not going to be dead because she put a bulletproof vest on. They made a point of showing that.
Well, she was still shot. I do believe blood was involved.
Oh no, yeah, I'd imagine the shock of being shot probably would have knocked her senseless. But they did make a concerted effort to show that she had a vest on, so it would have softened the blow somewhat. So we know, well, looking back now, didn't kill her.
I'd say in this final scene, there's a lot of good symmetry that you can compare the start of the film to the end of the film. Aside from it being quite the kind of coming full circle moment for Helen, being that this is where it all started, and you think it's come to the conclusion until, of course, you see the part with Daryl Lee Cullum, and then you're probably like, oh shit, she's so screwed after this. But also you've got MJ at the start of the film. She and Ruben Dermot Mulroney have a scene where they're practicing their shooting and firing and aiming and all that stuff, and she's basically criticizing him for just going straight in and going shooting people up like crazy. And he's like, well, how would you do it? And she illustrates that she would shoot the shoulder of the gun hand, causing the person to drop the gun, meaning you haven't taken a life and your calm is okay. And at this moment in the movie, she gets a second chance to do this again. You know, she did it with the gunman who killed Ruben. Obviously, that didn't work out. But she's kind of stuck to her guns and she's like, I'm still not prepared to go and take a life. I'm not like these people. I'm not a killer. So she does, you know, he goes to stab Helen. She shoots him in the shoulder, giving him a chance to surrender. He looks at her and he's clearly so far gone. He knows that there's no turning back. And he's like, he has that look of, I'm going to die in infamy. And she's like, well, I gave you a chance, and shoots him and kills him. So it's just such a great moment where nothing is just random or just like, let's quickly finalize this up. It's like everything is still connected to the other moments in the film.
Yeah, it was almost like a redemption for the character after her, because it wasn't a mistake. When she shot the assailant in the police station who then went on to kill Ruben, it wasn't a mistake. She shot him as per the guy in the shoulder, which would have incapacitated him. It's just that basically the guy got a second wind and in his protest managed to get his gun and shoot Ruben. So
I still think that scene was a bit unnecessary, but I also still hated the character who shot Ruben. Not just because he shot Ruben, it's like, dude, you just got shot by a detective in a police station. What do you think is going to happen to you after this?
Yeah. Lay down, just give
me. It's like, no, you have to pick up the gun and then shoot someone. I'm like, you are never seeing the outside of a prison cell, buddy.
But that is just film sport. Is that the scene which you said they could have done without?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it might be, but it... I guess execution-wise, because, I mean, having Ruben out of the picture then allows MJ to have to branch out by herself, so it impacts her, it impacts... Hudson as well, so the ramifications of the scene are perfectly fine. But yeah, I guess had they found another way, but then if they had Ruben killed by the serial killer, I think that would have been too cliche. That would have been, you know, too on the nose to have him have the serial killer be the one to do it. So
true.
Yeah, I certainly see that point. But in the end, what we didn't mention as well is that when MJ she's been shot, Helen then basically does everything she can to mess up the meticulously planned murder, the murder scene in the bathroom. She's to unhinge Foley even more. So she's basically trying to mess everything up to ruin his plan, because he can't then go through with the perfect murder if it wasn't exactly the same as it was in the beginning of the film. Mm. That basically starts to send him crazy. But yeah, like I say, they get out onto the roof. MJ shoots Foley in the shoulder to incapacitate him. He's having none of that, and like you say, he wants to go out as some sort of serial killing martyr. Doesn't work because he gets shot. He's dead. He's gone. And seemingly everything's okay. You know, everyone's going to go back, everyone's going to have a lovely dinner together, life's going to go on. But as the final scene of the film shows, life isn't going to be normal for these characters, certainly not Helen.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's great that, you know, Helen is the brains of the film and MJ is the brawns. You know, they both have their role to play, and they work off each other quite well because they each have something to bring to the film. And I just think a lot about the script writing has a lot of realistic elements to it. The way that they've really thought about how does a serial killer act? What are they going to do? What is a specific serial killer like this? How are they going to act? A lot of it was very well thought out. And we know that there was so much that was put into the original draft of the script. And they made some very intelligent changes, which obviously good on them for being open to those changes. I wish some scripts today would do that. Looking at you, Truth or Dare. But why did that happen?
The worst film of the year.
But, you know, like how originally MJ was going to be written as a male character who was then going to have a romantic relationship with Helen. Thank God they scrapped that idea.
Yes.
That would have completely pulled focus in a different direction. It's like, well, what are we going for? Is this a romance film or is this a thriller film? Make up your mind.
And he didn't really need the romance in it. There was little bits of romance in it, kind of nods and hints at it. And MJ's ex-husband is in the picture and he's kind of sniffing around, but never really. He's not at any point kind of malicious, really.
Yeah.
But so there's kind of hints at love and all, but he didn't need it in this film.
Yeah, it's good that it's subtle enough to show you that, you know, these people are human beings, you know, they have emotions.
Yeah.
But not enough to say, we're going to overplay this for some ridiculous reason that makes no sense. They also had a scene that I believe that was going to be put towards the end, I think during Peter Foley and Helen's confrontation scene, that they were going to do a flashback showing Peter Foley's childhood and just what horrible events in his childhood led to him becoming the serial killer that he is today. On one hand, the very curious person inside me is like, oh, what did happen? What is this thing? Because I'm a morbidly curious person. But I think it's good that they kept that out. I think it's good with how it is, because we at least have that scene between Helen and MJ where we have our wonderful cameo by the police, thanks to their song Murder by Numbers. So lovely when it turns into a musical, where he's basically using the lyrics to the song to talk about himself and what his plans are next. And she's translating the lyrics that, because he's picked these, they must mean something to him. And she says, something happened to this one, something happened in his childhood that made him this way. And then she uses evidence to various other serial killers who suffered traumatic experiences in their childhood that did kind of turn them into, or at least contribute to, what they became later on in their years. So we at least have that one thing that gives us a bit of an explanation. So because we have that, it's okay that they took that other scene out. It balances it out.
Sometimes I like a bit of backstory and some exposition to explain how we got to where we are now, but sometimes I just like evil to be evil, basically. I don't need to know what happened to them as a kid, that, you know, their dad didn't buy them their favourite candy bar, chocolate bar, and then they just went mental or whatever it was, or the kitten got called Fluffy rather than Nuts. I don't need to know that all the time. Sometimes it's just the intrigue which keeps you going. A lot of prequel films can ruin the magic of what you thought, and I'm not talking about any in particular necessarily, but you can get, sometimes explanations don't help, or they, you know, they kind of soften the blow, and I'm glad that they didn't go that direction here. And I can see why listening to Sting would turn you into a serial killer, because my urge to kill absolutely rises whenever I hear his voice. Apart from Fields of Gold, that's alright, that song is, it's very clever how they use that song though, and it's quite ironic, obviously the title of the song, and it worked so well in the confines of this story. So
yeah.
Sting, I'll let you off for this one, but also he didn't seem like the sort of guy who'd let his song be used in a film about serial killers and murders, but you know, well on, keep up the tantric sex, mate, but
publicity
is
publicity.
It is, but he's still an idiot for the most part. As a disclaimer, if you like Sting, fine, I apologise, but I don't like Sting. But apart from Message in a Bottle as well, that's all right. At the end of the film, we see Daryl Lee in his cell. And one of the other things I like about the film was he never gets out of that cell. He doesn't have some miraculous escape, or it doesn't all coincide with his release, blah, blah. He's in his cell still, so we know he's locked away with a copy of Helen Hudson's book. He's writing a letter to another serial killer, and we find out that he's actually instructing somebody else on how to kill Helen. And we find out that he was the chuckling puppeteer behind the whole thing. He was aiding Foley the whole time. And his letter is a good luck letter to whomever this next serial killer is to kill Helen. So she's just gone through this trauma, and we now know that Daryl Lee is the mastermind. Yeah, he's the mastermind. He's not going to stop until she's dead, basically.
Hmm.
So what did you think about that as an ending? Because this is an absolutely downbeat ending, I think.
I think it's brilliant. It's also something that in no way during the course of the film do you see coming. And because I started watching the film, you know, originally when I was so young, it took me many years of watching it and many years of growing up before I finally understood what that scene meant. Obviously, this film is not meant for children. But you just realize that, you know, basically what's happening is that people who have these killer impulses are reaching out to a serial killer, which definitely does happen. You know, it happened especially with Ted Bundy. He had fucking women outside his prison going, "I want your baby."
It's mental.
The man got married in prison and I can't even get a date. This is ridiculous.
Right, let's set up somebody with Ashley.
Please, not a serial killer.
We're going to get a serial killer.
Thanks. But
serialkillerdating.com.
Well, there probably is something like that on the dark web. But just all these people are kind of reaching out for him because they see, like, themselves in him. They want that guidance. Not much guidance here. And he is completely basking in it, living it. Like, he's kind of looking at himself as, like, a messiah, and these are his disciples. And he's using them, like, he seems very content to be in prison because he can do all these things from here. And, you know, what are they going to do? Throw him in jail? Oh, wait, he's already there. Big whoop.
Exactly.
So he can do all this. And I also love that, as you mentioned, there is her book is found in his cell. And her book is also in Peter Foley's little serial killer den. He had her book as well,
which really
coincides with how she says, "They all know me. I'm the poster girl for serial killers." And it's like, oh, no, it's actually true. They all have a book on standby. But, yeah, it's just like it's that moment. I've always said in horror films, I like it when there isn't, when there's not a happy ending, because I feel like it's a bit more realistic. I don't want people walking away like, yay, everything's so great.
Yeah.
Life doesn't happen like that. What are you talking about? We will walk away completely miserable waiting for the next shoe to drop. And this is what exactly happens. You know, Helen thinks that it's all done, the killer's gone, and then you realize, oh no, he actually wasn't the bad guy, it was him, and he's just getting started. And I think that's a brilliant little bit to add. I just the way that final shot just the camera just stays on Harry Connick Jr. and he just stares down the camera and he's just occasionally blinking, but nothing else. Just occasionally blinking. And I'm like, can they roll the credits now? Because this is really creepy.
Yeah. Or did you find it alluring?
No!
I bet that I'll get that out there. Firstly, congratulations on the use of Big Whoop. I'm always a massive fan when that gets used in any conversation. Big Whoop.
I think I must say that several times a day.
Big Whoop to you, then.
Thank you.
I like these kind of endings. I like the fact that there wasn't a conclusive ending. It's very ambiguous because... Well, I thought it was not ambiguous at all, but what happens after the film is ambiguous. Yeah. Yeah. I like the fact that you leave the cinema or you leave the film on your television or whatever, and you think about what happens next. What might have happened next? They don't explicitly tell you. Well, you know that Daryl Lee's sent off another one of his disciples on a mission, but we don't know if he succeeds, we don't know if he fails. And it leaves the viewer in that kind of uncertain sense, which, as you've quite rightly said, is extremely realistic. This guy's alive still. He's still in prison. He's probably going to be there for the rest of his life. He can be dispatched letters. It also shows that they don't read the letters that go out.
Yeah, it was 95.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah. People couldn't read in 95. The yeah, it's just realistic. Like I say, I would have think the ending would have bombed more had there been that scene at the end when they're at like one of the old policeman's bars, sitting there with their shots, kind of clinking them, saying, you know, that's it, the danger's gone, what will you do now, kind of thing, blah, blah.
I would have imagined that would have just... if they were going to go something that was very cliche, they would have, like, done a flash forward 5 months later, Helen's made a full recovery and she's now back to giving speeches at colleges, and it's like, yeah. Oh, yeah, you had it for 13 months, but you magically got over it in 5 months after you were attacked again. Of course, because that makes sense.
All it took was death to get somebody else's death to get you out to click you out of it. But I guess
I think a more realistic flash forward is 5 months later we find out Helen Hunt has been, you know, committed to the insane asylum because she has completely had a breakdown.
Who's Helen Hunt?
I meant to, Helen Hunt's insane. Now we're all making issues.
Yes, I'm so pleased now. Agoraphobia, excellent. So I guess the million-dollar question, which has been on my mind for this whole pod. Daryl Lee Cullum, did he receive Sigourney's sweaty squirrel covers?
I'm going to vote with no.
Well, that's decisive enough for me. Sigourney, that is the reason why Daryl Lee's still after you, Hudson. You didn't send your granders. Do it and you'll be safe.
Oh, Jesus, that's disturbing.
Yeah, but he asked for them. And he's obviously just a beacon of manners. He asked for something. She said yes, and she hasn't done what she said she'd do.
Yeah, but he was already kind of like, well, sending serial killers after her before he asked for her underwear. So
it's just good grace and manners. If you're gonna say you're gonna do something, at least do it, or at least just send somebody else's and pretend.
Ugh, gross.
Yeah. But enough of Sigourney Weaver's undercrackers. That's Copycat. That's the main beats of the film, and I guess now is the time to ask the real million-dollar question is, what are your thoughts on the film as a whole? Because I know that this was a film that you specifically wanted to talk about, so what did you think about it overall and any kind of impact it's had on you or the thriller genre?
It still, to this day, is my absolute number one favourite psychological thriller of all time. I think... You know, some people love to say that films like this glorify serial killers, and I do believe that there are some films that do that because they're more interested on how many people are going to watch this and what money they can get off it than ever showing anything that's, you know, tasteful or respectful. This one is not all about gore and violence. Most of that stuff is left off scene. I mean, there are a couple of throat slitting scenes, but we're not like watching blood gush out of a person. It's like, oh, they're tossed aside. Nope, we're not focusing on that anymore. That's already happened. It's done. It's gone. But the script writing, I think, is so perfect. They really have gone about thinking. I mean, it's a psychological thriller, and they really have focused on the psychological aspects of. Especially our agoraphobic character. And our serial killer, I love that. And you would not ever notice this on the first watch. You definitely will notice it on multiple viewings, that Peter Foley actually appears several times in the film behind the scenes, not being a serial killer, just being an observer. He's there in the auditorium when Helen is giving her speech. This is where he hears it. This is where he gets part of his idea of how what kills he's going to do in what order. You see him after the most recent Boston Strangler copycat victim, and he's there in the precinct and he just casually says hi to one of the detectives, and they don't think anything of it because he's so unassuming. And then you realize, you're like, oh, he was the bad guy. Oh, he was really everywhere, but we didn't notice it. And that's so something that has happened in the real world. They've said it many times that some serial killers love to stick around and watch the police work. They really get a high off knowing that, you know, haha, it's like, you don't know I'm here. So I love that they did that. I'd say all of our characters are pretty well written and do all have their parts to play that work out so great. I think the music to this film is so perfect. Christopher Young composed the score to this, and it not only is so 90s, which is makes me love it more because I listen to it, I'm like, I feel like I'm being transported back to the 90s, and I love that, but it does exactly what a score is supposed to do, which is to not just reflect what the scene is, but to really amplify it and bring out what you should be feeling from this scene. And it's so perfect. It just is matches it so well. It has that tension, that suspenseful feeling to the music. It's just so spot on that it's just, yes, well done, well done.
I think Ashley likes this film.
Just a bit.
Yeah, the score absolutely hums and throbs like a pulse. Mm. Certainly in the one, possibly one of my favourite scenes from the film, which you didn't mention actually, is when Helen Hudson, her house, someone's in her house and he's basically stalking, it's like a cat and mouse game in her maze of a house, and the score in that particular scene is excellent. It really, really drives home the atmosphere of the scene. Somebody is in her house. We can only assume he's there to do something naughty to her, something bad. But the score really underpins that scene perfectly well. So yeah, that's great. I thought the acting, for the most part, was very decent. It's a slow film, but at the same time, it did also feel like it had some momentum to it.
Yeah.
And I don't mean it's slow in a negative way, because, you know, a fast-paced thriller, they don't always work. But the film was as methodical as its story. It took its time to get from where it needed to be. And I think, you know, for the vast majority of the time, it worked very well. It was well written. Mm. It's well directed. It looked good. It felt authentic, as we mentioned earlier on in the show. It did feel genuine. It didn't feel like a couple of just, you know, anybody's just pretending to be policemen or pretending to have agoraphobia and failing. It all felt very real. Sigourney Weaver herself said she's absolutely so proud of her performance in this film, and kind of,
good reason,
you know, regrets the fact that more people didn't see it, because she's so good in it. And for an actor of her calibre to put this, you know, firmly in the top one, two or three performances of her career, kind of goes to show how good she was. So if you haven't seen this film, I recommend you see it. Holly Hunter is, I think she's very good in most things. She was recently in The Big Sick, and she's probably the standout of that film. And she was an Academy Award winner by this time. She's very good. I did have reservations about her at the very start, because I did think, oh no, am I going to like her character? Is she too cocksure? But you know, that those fears are very, very, very quickly allayed. Ruben Gertz is good. William McNamara is very good when he gets a chance to be Peter Foley. He gets spat in the face in real life, and his reaction to that is really drives that scene. That Sigourney Weaver's the one who flops in his gob. Harry Connick Jr. is excellent as Daryl E. Cullum. Again, it's kind of against type for what he is known for. He was also in Independence Day quite I think the year after this film, and it's a different character. Same southern drawl, but a different character. So yeah, acting-wise, story-wise, it's a very decent film. There's some fantastic novelty ties, and the 90s nostalgia is strong with this one. You've got the old-school screensavers, the MS-DOS chat rooms, the novelty ties, like I mentioned, the haircuts, the baggy-looking suits. So if you are a 90s fiend, you're absolutely going to find a lot to feast on during this. But I guess what I'm trying to say was, I think this is a good film. I think it's a very decent thriller film. Why it hasn't been seen by quite as many people as maybe it should have been, I don't know why that is. There's a multitude of reasons. But if somebody came up to me and said, there's this film I've got called Copycat, I'm a bit iffy, should I watch it? I'd say absolutely. It's a very decent film. So to hear it's your number one psychological thriller, I find that very interesting as well.
Why? Because you're trying to figure out what does that make me?
Oh, I already know what you are. You're a psychotic serial killer.
Thanks a lot.
Now, Ashley is a very charming, delightful young lady. She's not a serial killer. So that is all in jest. And as I've mentioned before, I have the safety of distance so I can get away with saying that.
Goodness. At least for another year.
Yeah, then maybe my time is up. But no, Ashley is a delightful young lady, and I absolutely adore doing these shows with her. So, but yeah, Copycat, thank you. Copycat, I think, is a very decent film. What I'm going to enjoy doing is, in the subsequent shows we do each month, is kind of comparing this film and everyone we do, kind of almost creating like a personal league table. How does this film compare to, I don't know, the next film we're going to do and the one after? That's what I'm going to enjoy doing. So Copycat, I think it's a very decent film. I haven't really got any particular issues with it. I don't think, like you say, there are some moments which could have been done slightly differently, but I guess every film has those. I don't think there's any scenes in the film which ruin it. I think they're very clever in how they did it.
I would agree. I feel like there are some people who maybe because they didn't like it are trying to nitpick on what they didn't like about it, like trying to make a mountain out of a molehill. Like if you look at some of the things that are written under goofs on IMDb, I'm just like, oh, common sense doesn't really work with you, does it, people? Like they have two little ones where they're talking about in a scene where she's looking up the hillside strangler's victim, and they said that the name of the victim is incorrect. Then they're looking up the Son of Sand victim, and it says the name that they used on her and the date of when that person was killed were incorrect. I'm like, no, people, those are not incorrect. That's called they can't say those for legal reasons. You can't go and start using the actual victims' names unless you go to the families and get them to sign off on consent. So you have to change the names, and do you really want to be going around advertising on this specific day, at this specific time, a serial killer went and did this, and you should probably go and do the exact same thing on the exact same day? No, that's not they fucked up. It's they were trying not to get sued.
Yeah, it's inspiration. It's what I think it was called. Morbidly inspired by real events, but it would be ridiculous to basically just remake the killings on the big screen. My favourite goof was apparently the length of MJ's bangs changed throughout the movie. So somebody's gone up to their screen with a very tiny ruler, and I don't know if that's just the fact that she is further away in the shot. I don't know, but somehow somebody's realised that the length of her bangs have changed. But another cool bit of trivia was, because Sigourney Weaver's a fair bit taller than Holly Hunter, who's a midget like me, she had a lot of their scenes together are framed so they're almost the same height. So Sigourney Weaver will be sitting down, or she'll be further away in the shot, kind of a bit like the old Lord of the Rings trick. But I found that quite interesting as well. But yeah, some goofs are just a product of their time. Some are disrespect and some are just stupid. I mean, every film's got goofs in it.
I think it's just funny what some people consider a goof, and they don't try to think maybe there was a logical reason why that was done. So, like, if someone's saying, like, there was something, the computer screen, like, you can't actually do that with a computer, like, yeah, okay, that's fine. that you can say that's a goof, or maybe they just were like, it's a computer, who fucking cares? But when you're like, mm-hmm. oh, they didn't use the actual victim's name, it's like, yeah, and your point is...
Her bands are a different size throughout the whole film, having a meltdown.
I will say that the only goof that they mentioned that is actually a legitimate goof, I will give them this one, is that they say when Helen is reading the lyrics for the song from the police, and she's talking about a twosome or a threesome, and she says Ted Bundy killed three women at Chi Omega, the sorority house. He did attack three women at Chi Omega that night when he attacked, but two of them died, one of them survived. So technically she was wrong.
You fucking idiot, Weaver. sorry. Yeah, okay, that's a legitimate goof. But if, to be fair, every film we do in these episodes, which we're going to be doing forever, they're all going to have goofs, and some of them are going to be, some are going to have foundation, and other ones are just going to be ridiculous, like the length of bangs. But I guess, in terms of the film, Laszlo Kovacs, who did the cinematography, did a great job. Christopher Young, very good score. I struggle to find anything that was majorly wrong. It isn't my favourite thriller of all time. That doesn't mean I don't like it. It's not certainly not in my bottom half. It's certainly in the top echelons. But I can't think of much that was really wrong with this film.
I believe, are we talking about your favourite one next?
Possibly are. But in true thriller style, I will leave that anticipation to melt in everybody's minds until they too become serial killers with anticipation.
Oh, great. This isn't a podcast about serial killer movies. It's a podcast on how to make serial killers.
I'm trying to recruit disciples. I already have one on the other end of the line. Or am I the disciple?
Well, that would actually refer to me as a genius mastermind. I might just take that.
Master chef, for sure.
I could be watching
absolutely.
That right now.
Well, I'm glad you've given me your time. But if anyone also, Ashley's a fantastic pudding chef. So if you ever need a pudding, give her a call.
I didn't make a pudding. I made a dessert. I made a cocktail dessert. An alcoholic.
No, dessert pudding. It's all the same.
No, it's not.
It looked bloody good.
Thank you.
So, Copycat. Clearly, Ashley's going to recommend this film. Am I right in saying that?
Hells yes.
I too am going to recommend that. So, we've got a thumbs up from down under and a thumbs up from up here. So, Copycat, for the first movie and the first episode of Thrilling Nights, is, again, I've mentioned before, I can't use MJ's song because I'll get sued, but it's a double recommendation from us. So, if you haven't seen it, go check it out and... we'll be interested to hear what you think. If you do see it and you do like it, or if you see it and you hate it, let us know. Just be polite in what you say.
Hell yes. And if anyone bad mouths it, I might just turn into a serial killer and hunt you down.
There we go. The seeds have been sown. Might being will, being definitely. So I guess that brings the first episode to a close now. So Thriller Nights episode 1 is dead. Bum. So thank you so much, Ashley, for coming on. I'm looking forward to doing this with you every month. And the stuff you brought to the show was excellent. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It is a pleasure and it will continue to be a pleasure.
Fabulous. So for the benefit of the rest of the world, where can they find you in the cyberspace?
God, probably just, you know, floating around like a little ball of useless information. No, you can find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Tumblr, and all under the Movie Oracle.
She's literally taken over the world there. If you want to find me, and let's face it, why wouldn't you? You can find me at whatiwatchtonight.co.uk, all of my reviews, podcasts, blogs, movie moments, and other stuff is on there, other junk is on there. Also on Twitter and Instagram, just search for What I Watch Tonight, and you'll find me on there. We both love to chat movies, so do engage with us politely. And if you've got nothing nice to say, then sod you. But if you like this show, tell the world, share it with everybody. If you know people who like thrillers, turn them on to the idea of checking this show out. Not because we want the listens, but because we want to engage with other fellow fans out there. So
and also because
like this,
he wants the listens.
Why wouldn't I? And if you don't like this show, don't tell anyone because it does nobody any favours. So, until next time, from me, see ya, and from Ashley,
ta-ta.